Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi Kovacs here in Mishnah Yomi continues for Erev Shabbos Bechukotai in the 8th chapter of Sota, Mishnah Zayin, B'mei Devarim Amorim. When do these words apply, meaning when do we exempt certain soldiers from fighting in combat during a war? And as we spoke out the last few days, there are many exemptions, and some of them appear that the Torah has designed a system where people who are afraid or have committed Averot, transgressions, and are embarrassed to leave, they have an excuse, a positive excuse to also leave if that would detract from the effectiveness of their unit if they would remain there. So these exemptions apply to Milchemet Rashut, in a war which is Rashut, which is optional. Aval Milchemet Mitzvah, a war which is a commandment, Hakol Yotzim, everybody goes out to the battlefield. Afilu Hatan Mehadro, even the Hassan from the wedding hall, the Kala Mechupato, and the Kala from under the Huppah. Now, literally, they're not going to drag the Hassan and Kala out of the wedding to fight, but the idea is everybody's going, and of course, the women are not there to fight, but to do logistic support, to do cooking and baking and repairing uniforms and the like. So what does it mean, Milchemet Rashut, where it's optional? Like, what's with an optional war? So the example given is King David, David the Melech, went to war for Aram Tzova and Aram Naharaim. These are lands, modern-day Syria. Syria was conquered by King David, by David HaMelech, to expand the borders of Eretz Yisrael and expand the amount of taxes that he could get from conquered nations, get his exact tribute, and have more income for Am Yisrael. So those wars are certainly considered Rashut, where King David had the option. There's an interesting Gemara at the beginning of Brachot, right around the beginning of the Talmud in Brachot, where David HaMelech is asked by his financial ministry. They say there's not enough money, and he says, "Well, let's ask the Sanhedrin and the Urim and Tumim and consult and see if we should go to war against our neighbors who seem to have a lot of money right now." So we see from the Talmud it wasn't just King David wanting to get wealth and plunder. It was something done for the needs of the community on the basis of consulting the Sanhedrin and prophecy through the Urim and Tumim. Now the Mishnah brings another opinion. Amaru Yehuda b'mei devar memorim. When are there exemptions from war? B'melchemet mitzvah, a mitzvah type war. Aval melchemet chova, but an obligation type war. Hakol yotzin, everyone goes out. Afilu chatan mechadro v'chal mikupato. Even a chatan and kala would be involved in chova. So his definition of chova is the conquest, the kibush of Eretz Yisrael, and the war against Amalek. That would be definitely a chova. Everyone would agree that there are no exemptions. But a mitzvah, this sort of middle category from Yehuda, it's explained by the Bartnur and other Mefarshim, it's a war that's a good idea as sort of a preventative or preemptive war, where you don't want the enemies of the Jewish people to gain strength and gain numbers. So you sort of want to, thin the ranks of those people who hate the Jews and in the future will become a threat. And perhaps the Six-Day War is the best example of this, because everybody knew that Am Yisrael was threatened, Eretz Yisrael was threatened, and the war was imminent, but it was the Israeli army, the Jewish people, decided when and where and how to actually start prosecuting that war. Now, of course, if Jewish lives are threatened, there is a humongous mitzvah to do anything you can to save Jewish lives, so that would put a lot of military operations today in the category of a mitzvah, perhaps even a chova, though we don't pass on that to be Yehuda. There's also an interesting note that Amalek, there's no more Amalek genetically. The tribe of Amalek is long gone, but there are people that rabbis call ideological Amalek, people who would gladly step into the shoes of Amalek, who if it looks like an Amalek and acts like an Amalek, you could consider it halachically an Amalek, even if genetically it's not. It's a complex issue, and consult your local military officers and Orthodox rabbis for details. Let's go on to chapter 9, Egla Arufa, the decapitated calf. Now, this we're going to see is a ritual that was performed when there was an unidentified corpse. They don't know who killed him. And it was sort of, in some ways, it was a way to draw attention to this murder mystery and try to find the culprit, and a way to get kapara, an atonement, for not protecting each Jewish life as appropriate. So B'lashon HaKodesh, it's the ceremony said in Hebrew, Shemar ki matzei cholul be'adama v'yatzu zikin erav shavtecha. When they find a dead body on the ground, they will go out to the judges and the elders. And the psukim by Egla Rufa, they say davar dibor, they have to speak, and speaking by Matan Torah was Hebrew, so too Lashon HaKodesh here. So I explain how many, shosha mi beit din agodol, shebushalayim. So it has to be three judges from the high court in Yerushalayim, Hayyotin. They would go out, members of the Sanhedrin would go out and join the local elders and judges for this official ceremony. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Hamisha, he said there's actually needs five judges. Shenemar, because it says Zikenecha Shnaim. So Zikenecha means at least two elders. Two elders. Shoftecha Shnaim. Judges, plural, that's at least two. And Beit Din Shakul. And a Beit Din, a court, to do a judicial proceeding is never an even number because they're going to have to take a vote. So Masifin Alehim Od Echad. So Zikenecha and Shoftecha, you have 2 plus 2 and you need one more. So your Beit Din has an odd number. More about the Egla Arufa tomorrow. Yishar Kochachem, good Shabbos.